This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Joe Ross is here with a poem to tell you who he is.
Thank you. If Mamie Till was the mother of God. If Mamie Till was the mother of God, one of the Ten Commandments would forbid whistling. No one would wear cotton clothing. Every cotton field would be burned in praise of 14-year-old boys and their teeth. If Mamie Till was the mother of God, every river would be still, so nothing thrown in could travel downstream. Barbed wire could only be worn as a necklace by senators. If Mamie Till was the mother of God, every coffin lid would be glass, so even God could see how baptisms are done in Mississippi.
That is the voice of Joe Ross. There are things about your poetry, major things that are so distinctive that are just Joe Ross. Mm. And they are style and themes, which we'll get to. But I want to talk about your style first, because it is precise couplets or perfect terza rima with three lines. And you can go page after page, and the aesthetic on the page is so exact. What does this say about your temperament or your blood flow or your pacing? What does this say about you, this energy flow, which is so precise and constant?
I'm not sure. As a younger poet, I began to write several years ago to do initial drafts in the two-line in couplets. It helped me see options for line breaks better. I could see just sort of ways to add words, to remove words, to keep it sort of tighter. And I don't always stick to that exactly, but I have generally then stuck to that. I don't know that it means my temperament or personality is as exact as the couplets, or is as exact as they look sort of visually on the page. Maybe my temperament yearns for that kind of exactness.
I think it is a way of fencing in the tumultuous stories you tell, and a way of controlling them. But let us hear some more of your beautiful obsessions.
Thank you. Let me, on something of the same theme, a poem is from this new book, Ache, on John Coltrane's Alabama. And so John Coltrane wrote this song thinking of the girls killed in the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. There are no words for brick dust or fallen beams, only a piano rumbling, a ceiling collapsing. There is no sky in September when a stand-up bass has to preach forgiveness, when an angry man drives away from a church smiling. Cymbals wince in shock, stunned at the space between drumbeats, pauses in a preacher's cadence that convert no one. Drums only sing in one language, but the maker of this Confederate memory does not recognize this tongue. Pressing breath into a saxophone cannot resuscitate polished Sunday shoes, a blue satin dress, a dead girl's hand pointing to a window.
Give us another one.
In the same series on John Coltrane's Reverend King, last year of his life, John Coltrane wrote a song in honor of Dr. King. The tenor sax sings the concrete of Auburn Avenue, grandparents' front porch. It whispers Morehouse and tries to read music it hasn't learned yet. It gathers into a man's voice to chant Boston. Here the sax weaves a love song, falling over itself for a rhythm that could carry it, outlive it. It deepens and moves south to a Montgomery of empty buses, kitchen prayers, bombs, threatened and real. Then drums rise to an angry Birmingham, the verses hum jailed. Their tones are letters, grace notes, staccato police batons slice the air like the conductors of an insane choir. Coltrane's breath rushes through the saxophone now. The tune terrors in Vietnam. It prays scared in Selma. Its notes are water hoses, dog teeth, indifference. It sings symphony in Washington, chaos in Chicago. 1963 was cruel to this melody, this unfinished lunch counter where four little girls sit side by side and eat nothing. So finally, he puts down the sax as it fills with tears, unplayable. He picks up the bass clarinet because it sounds more like fury, like staring down a president. This song knows harmony. It is a choir called Watts. It sings riot in a new tongue, the language of the unheard. This song swirls now. It fills the world house with a straight-spined melody. This tune sings garbage men who are men. This rhythm has walked to a mountaintop. It tastes like a promise. So it clears its throat and soars, singing Memphis.
Joe Ross at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. You take crimes against humanity. You take injustices of the world. And you turn your faith into action. Now, you write about Trayvon Martin, you write about Jesus Christ, Tupac Shakur. You write about, you know the New Testament to the letter, chapter, and verse. Help me to describe what you do with your faith and with your knowledge, with your great spiritual life. How do you turn this into poetry?
I go first to the images. I feel like the images of mother and child or Mary at the foot of the cross, Mary holding the dead body of Jesus.
You have several poems about that.
Yeah. Because to me that those images, I was raised with those images. You talked about being raised Catholic too. I was raised in those images, and those images are powerful for me, for many people, I think. And I think even beyond faith, the mother and child image is primal. It's deeply human. And so thinking about those who suffer certainly is a theme in my writing that has come out of my faith, though my faith has changed greatly over the years, of course, like most people's, I suppose.
But you're an activist, a poetry activist.
I try. We have good examples here in Washington, D.C., like Ethelbert Miller and others, yeah. Because it matters.
Poetry. And you take on the hard stuff. You do take on the hard stuff. You take on police brutality. You take on, but you do it in such a different way, Joe.
Well, thank you. I deeply believe that poetry can change things. It can motivate. It can heal. It can help us to think things through more deeply. It insists when language is going off the rails.
It insists.
Yeah.
Joe Ross is the author of three books of poetry, and Ache is coming out. Mm-hmm. We can get it any minute soon. Gospel of Dust was in 2013, and Meeting Bone Man a year before that. And his poetry has appeared widely in publications, the Los Angeles Times, Poet Lure, Tidal Basin Review, Beltway Poetry Quarterly, Sojourners, and in many, many anthologies. He teaches English and creative writing at Gonzaga College High School in Washington. And we're going to hear some more of this astonishing, singular poetry.
Thank you. A couple of summers ago, when we were watching so many young people crossing the southern border of the U.S., and Americans had varied reactions to all of that, I discovered something that I had not learned before, that a Mexican saint, Saint Toribio, was this Mexican priest to whom apparently lots of these migrants pray to get across, that they would find water in the desert or something. So here are a couple of poems about Saint Toribio. Saint Toribio's sweatshirt. Your wrinkled image secured inside his sweatshirt, safety pinned on four sides so he feels you press his own sweating skin. You, a serious saint, lips that say prayers, eyes that mean martyrdom. Your stories are legend among the near dead, that they dreamed of you and woke to water, that they prayed to you and found apples in the desert, that they gazed at your image and heard your warning to go back, later to learn there was more desert than they could breathe. Your hands anointed for wandering souls, your hands tilting the chalice to the lips of a starving faith. And St. Toribio Water Litany. For tongues gone gray as greed, pray for us. For mothers dropping the last wet diamonds onto lips of ash, pray for us. For throats where even the blood is dried, pray for us. For amber eyes that see a shimmering which is a whole country laughing, pray for us. For the ache that is an underground river, pray for us. For the oasis dream that comes too easily to the scared, pray for us. Mm. Who have no country, no air, only a river, a fence, and you.
Joe, I guess the only way we can bear it is to write it, right?
Sometimes that's right, yeah.
Is that what you teach your students?
Of course, yeah. That the things maybe you can't talk about or don't want to talk about, write them out. It's a way of facing things, right? It's a way of facing turning around in your dream and shaking hands with the monster instead of spending a life running, you know? So poetry can do that for us. It can do that with us to help us to name things. Once you name it, you can do something about it. If you haven't named it, it's gonna wrestle you to the floor, right?
I like that.
Yeah.
And the chaos.
Yeah.
It's a way of clearing it up. I mean, right. Just for a moment, just for that moment.
That's right.
But it's like meditation, one person at a time.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
And I would like to talk about your sensory qualities.
Okay.
And the things that are so different about your work. There is one of your Luke poems, The Last Supper, and in it, how many Last Supper poems have we had? But you
not enough.
You talk about the sound of the bread breaking.
Yeah.
The sound of the bread breaking. Who would have thought of that? And in your last poem, the sweat against the t-shirt.
Yeah.
The sweat against the t-shirt. You always come at it at an angle which is unpredictable, to say the least, but always from the senses.
That's how I experience the world. It's how we experience the world. And I think if we want to communicate something through a poem, we've got to use the senses. Then people can see it and taste it and maybe feel it. And maybe, I think, smell and taste are often the hardest things to communicate in writing. But that's how we experience the world. And so for me, it's sort of all over the place. And it's what I spend a lot of time with, I think.
But what made you think of the sound of the bread breaking? There's no way to know, right?
I don't know. I think I was trying to think of, he's taking the bread and thinking of it as his own body and trying to communicate to them that he will be broken like this.
Oh.
And I'm thinking, if someone said that to me, wouldn't I gasp? And that's what I was kind of thinking of.
The breakage.
Yeah. Yeah.
Joe Ross is here at the Library of Congress. This is The Poet and the Poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and I'm proud to have him read more.
Thank you. Well, let me read that poem, Supper. It reflects on Luke 24, The Last Supper.
How do you know each of those verses? Were you Jesuit trained?
I was raised Catholic. I went to Jesuit college as an undergrad.
I knew it. I caught you.
You did.
Because if you're just raised Catholic, all you get is the catechism.
But I was a priest for some years, too. And so I was reflecting on these texts out loud sometimes.
Oh, Joe, what a contribution you've made to
well,
the
thanks.
World. Go ahead.
I don't know about all that, but here's this. He knew it was coming and that it tasted like ash, mortal and unavoidable. So as they watched, he lifted a loaf of bread, a perfectly glazed tomb of wheat, and tore it into life-sized pieces of everyone he knew. The breaking of bread is not silent. Mm. It makes a sound like gasping, like shock, like trying to find a word or a breath where there is none.
Holy work.
Trying to make it so, yeah.
Yeah. Give us another poem.
Let me find one that puts together two loves. One is that some of those scriptural texts, and the other is my love for graffiti art, which tries to memorialize sometimes. So see what you think of this. Half of this is a found poem, The Graffiti Artist's Last Supper. He popped the spray paint can and aimed while they were at supper, shooting a stream straight and clean. He took the bread, blessed it, and broke it, creating an arching tombstone, and gave it to his disciples, saying, "For you, little brother, take this, all of you, and eat." Because sometimes only graffiti can say, "This is my body, given up for you." Tonight, the stealth artist is alone, trying to do this in memory of me. When supper was ended, he tried to remember, to memorize your heartbeat. So he took the cup. Again, he gave the wall his best three-dimensional shots of thanks and praise to his young friend killed that day, while he gave the cup to his disciples, being nothing but a kid. He said, "Take this, all of you, because living is nothing but yearning for food and drink. This is the cup of my blood that settles into the concrete street, the blood of the new and everlasting lament of a mother whose cries seal a truth covenant. It will be shed for you in paint that tastes like anger, and for all, so that sins may be forgiven. Now every time he paints a name, he will do this in memory of me."
That is really a terrific take on graffiti.
Thank you.
Joe Ross. I was reading Jane Hirschfield's essays this morning, and she mentions Blackmer, the poet, saying something which struck me. Poetry's task is to increase the available stock of reality. So I thought of you today. How do you think your poetry is making reality realer?
Well, I hope by using some of those senses, by describing things in a sensory way and hopefully well, some of the time at least. And I think also by facing some of the things that people don't want to talk about. I'm a white poet, but I write a lot about race. I think that reality is realer and we want to love it. I love the world. I hope we all sort of love the world, but we have to love its sorrows, and we have to face its sorrows at least, and we have to face its broken parts. And that's often, I don't always know why, but that's often where my interest is drawn. So I feel sort of nudged to those places.
I can't imagine you without your art. What would you be?
Yeah.
All that feeling.
I don't know.
All that observation.
Yeah.
And you're teaching young people to approach the world through that lens.
Exactly. Trying almost every day.
Are they anxious? Are they eager? Are they accommodating?
They're all of those things. We have a great kind of a poetry club to begin with.
How many are in it?
Maybe 10, 15 throughout the year. And people come and go. I always think students come to poetry when they need it. It's never going to be the biggest club in the world.
It's like marriage counseling.
Right. Right. It might have a better result, though. But
is this after school?
That part of it is. But then we also have two, in the spring, we have two semester-long classes of creative writing poetry for seniors.
Just for seniors.
Yeah. And they love it.
Well, what's not to love?
I agree.
They get to tell their story.
Exactly.
Is it hard to get them to open their hearts at first?
Surprisingly not for me. I mean,
Why? Because you do it first.
I do, and I share a lot of my work with them too, and a lot of the poets that I love. They read a lot of other poems as well. I always tell them, if you're going to be a writer of poetry, you've got to be a reader of poetry. Most of them have never bought a book of poetry before, so I require them to buy three. Some of them hang back, but others are just chomping at the bit. They're anxious for it.
I'm here. I'm really happy to hear that because that is not always been the case.
Yeah,
certainly when I was growing up.
Yeah.
So you speak of such desperate consequences in the world, but you do it with such serenity.
Well, thank you. I think you've got to sort of face these things clear-eyed, right? You've got to, look at people that suffer from some of the race problems we have in America, look at people who suffer from poverty in their own countries.
Poetry is calming, even though talking about horrific things. It's very calming. So I was wondering what practice you engage in before you write.
Oh, I listen to music. I breathe. I read out loud often as I'm writing.
And get in a place.
Yeah.
Joe Ross lives in Washington, D.C. He's been a Pushcart Prize nominee for six of his poems. And his poem, If Mamie Till Was the Mother of God, won the 2012 Pratt Library Little Patuxent River Review Prize. And that was in the front of the Enoch Pratt Library.
Right.
Wasn't that cool?
Right. And it's a great library for poets. Yeah.
I know, a full-length picture.
Yeah.
Where else can you get on
right.
the marquee?
Right.
And more poetry for us, Joe.
How about George Zimmerman's Options?
February. Maybe we should tell people who he was.
Sure. George Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin and was acquitted of that crime in Florida. George Zimmerman's Options. Look at the rain from the kitchen window. Think about staying inside. Return to the couch in front of the television. Marvel at Dwayne Wade's perfect follow-through. Listen to your mother's footsteps upstairs. Consider taking a ride around the neighborhood. Consider not. Back out of the driveway slowly. Hope there's not a bike on the sidewalk behind you. Wonder why you didn't check. Smile to yourself for stopping fully at each stop sign. Round corners slowly. Ask yourself why anyone would be walking in this weather. Notice the pulse of the windshield wipers. Muse that it feels peaceful to you. Watch the hooded person on the sidewalk in the next block. Slow down your car. Feel your annoyance at today's teenagers. Smile at how foolish that annoyance seems in the rain. Decide to pull up next to this person. Pull up next to this person. Realize he is a teenage boy. Pull forward as you notice he does not stop walking. Decide to roll down your window. Roll down your window. Look carefully through the rain as he turns to face you. Decide to ask him if he needs a ride. Ask.
Why did you end it that way?
Because I wish he'd done that. Mm-hmm. We all have options.
So
we make...
you also humanize Zimmerman in parts.
I try to, yeah. I don't think anybody's a monster. I think he did something monstrous.
But compassion on both sides of the gun.
Has to happen.
Mm. Yeah. Or we can't change anything.
No.
And so give us some more Joe Ross. Joe Ross at the Library of Congress, reading from his new book, Ache. What a great title.
Thank you. Some years ago, my friend artist Jefferson Pinder said he had seen a Confederate flag flying someplace and we should plan some night trip to take down the flag, which resulted then for me in a few poems. But this is Confederate flag dream number 3. I wake in the night and dress in darkness. Black hooded sweatshirt like a monk rising for night prayers, chanting in the language of thieves. I drive toward a house where a Confederate flag flies under an American flag from a pole in the front yard. I park many yards away so I won't be seen. Then I walk crouched, hidden, whispering treason psalms. I can tell I'm close to the house because it smells like rope, like a burning church. I creep toward the flagpole and watch the house. There is no light, but it breathes like a sleeping dog, like kerosene. I lower the flags. The pulleys groan like cowards. Distant voices scream. Crowds laugh. Ropes tighten on straining flesh. I reach the flag, unhook it, and fold its terrors into my pack. I raise the American flag back up, but only to half-mast.
Powerful.
Thank you.
When people read Ache, what do you wish they would say about it or take away from it?
I hope they think about these, the things for which we ache. And some of them are good things. We ache for love. We ache to tell somebody we love them. We ache to hold that person sometimes. We ache with grief. But we also ache from injustice. We ache from sorrow. We ache from losses. And so I just hope, maybe for myself and then for others, that by facing and entering into some of those aches, we heal them a little bit. They lean toward the positive kind of ache as opposed to the painful kind.
For a single syllable word.
It's doing a lot, isn't it?
You did a good job.
Yeah.
And let us have a final poem.
This is, there's a section of poems in Ache that are in The Voice of Nelson Mandela. So this is Nelson Mandela speaks to Trayvon Martin. I walk down Fox Street in Johannesburg at dawn. A light rain darkens my shoes. They scrape against the small stones. I am standing in the doorway when I see you across the street, on the corner, looking at me. You wear no hood today. You smile and walk toward me. I smile and wait for you. The day begins here. Coffee and tea stands push back their canvas covers. A whistle sings from the train station. Your arms swing at your sides like only a teenage boy's arms can swing. You look like you might open your mouth to sing. There is no SUV in sight. I'm not sure how to greet you, so I look at your wet, grass-stained shoes, then back at your 17-year-old face. I say, come in, out of the rain.
Poet of Conscience, Joe Ross. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation. Additional support is by Friends of Poetry, Maria Van Buren, Longan Ambrose, and Hiram LaRue. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.